This is the Comics Alternative, episode 213, Recent Crime Comics, part 1. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Comics Alternative. I'm Derek.
And I'm Andy, and we're two guys with PhDs talking about comics.
And on this episode, Andy and I are going to be looking at recent crime comics. And in fact, this is the first of a two-part show devoted to recent comics about crime. But before we get into those reviews, we want to let all of you know that this episode of the Comics Alternative is brought to you by the wonderful folks at Discount Comic Book Service. Go to dcbservice.com for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. There, you're going to find all DC, Marvel, Image, and Dark Horse titles at 40% off of the cover price if you pre-order. For all of the other publishers, you'll find that those discounts are 20 to 35% off of the cover price. And every single month, you're going to find some unbelievable specials. Sometimes those specials will be at 45% off of the cover price, sometimes at 50% off cover, but many times you can find discounts that are more impressive than that.
That's right, and this month, as in every month, they have a load of bundles that you can take advantage of, where you can get 45 to 50% off of a bunch of books from a single publisher. And this month, they have a load of bundles from DC, as well as Marvel and Valiant, so you can check those out.
That's right. You have great discounts for the month of November. But then again, every month you have incredible discounts at Discount Comic Book Service. Their website is dcbservice.com. You got to go there for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. And after you do get your books there, please be sure to send them an email and tell them that the two guys with PhDs sent you.
That's right.
Andy, we have a lot on our plate for not only this week, but also next week's show, because as we teased on our preview show, which went up last week, we're doing a two-part episode series devoted to recent crime comics, and there are a lot that have come out in the past few months. And in fact, what we're going to do today is to discuss these titles: Carver, A Paris Story, Angel City Number 1, Moonshine Number 1, Trigger Man Number 1, Peepland Number 1, Black Dahlia, and The Fix, The First Trade. So there's a lot for us to talk about there. But before we jump into that discussion, we should say a few words to our listeners about another recent announcement that we made, and that was our revamped Patreon campaign.
Yeah, so that announcement went out just the other day, right?
Yeah, it went out the beginning of last week.
Okay.
So Andy and I have added to and enhanced the various reward levels that we had with our old Patreon campaign, and we thought that this would be a good way of relaunching what we do, offering both current and future patrons more, including a Mighty Damn Cool Comics Alternative t-shirt.
Yeah, I hope to see more people getting a hold of that t-shirt.
Yeah, so that'd be cool. And we're ready to send them out. So if you want to find out more about our new revamped Patreon campaign, go to www.patreon.com/comicsalternative. Or if you go to our website, comicsalternative.com, and click on the Support Us on Patreon banner that you'll see, then it'll take you right to where you want to be. You can watch the video and find out what the various reward levels are.
Yep, check it out.
Yeah. And in fact, we want to thank our newest podcast patron, and this is Sturgios Botakis, and he, I guess, joined up right after we sent out that announcement that we have a revamped campaign, and he is supporting us at a level to where he now becomes an official podcast patron. So thank you, Sturge.
Yeah, thanks, Sturge. And, we've mentioned Sturge before. He's a great guy. Mm-hmm. I get to see him just about every year at Heroes Con. He makes the trip over, and I enjoy getting a chance to chat with him and hang out.
Yeah, so he is our latest podcast patron, but he joins the noble ranks of others, and we should mention who these guys are. They include Scott Bufus, Nick Prolix, Christopher Baird, Partheek Thomas, Art Boucher, Daniel White, Christopher Michael, Paul Lai, Sal Good Sam, Michael Norhale, Don Witzel, Simon Brilsby, David Campbell, and Rainer Koshnick.
Yep, thanks, guys.
Thank you very much. So, Andy, let's get into the crime comics that we're going to be talking about on this episode. We're going to start with Chris Hunt's Carver, A Paris Story, which was released in trade form back in September from Z2 Comics. But before we really get into that one, let's mention there a variety of crime comics that are recent, let's say over the past 4 or 5 months, that we could have included in this discussion. But we didn't because we've discussed them on previous shows. And I'm thinking of things like Dark Corridor, Limbo, Weird Detective, Control, Tyler Cross, Angola, Kill or Be Killed, Sombra, The Black Dahlia, that was the adaptation of the James Ellroy book, Cousin Joseph, and then Black Monday Murders.
Yeah, so the crime genre is flourishing right now in comics, and I do think that the selection we're going to discuss does show some of the variety of that genre that's showing up in comics, but also some of the examples too of kind of playing around with the genre or even melding it with other genres.
Yeah. So starting with our first book, Carver, A Paris Story, this, I think the first issue of that from Z2 Comics came out last year, I believe it was. Now, did you read the series when it was in its original single-issue run?
No, I didn't. So did it run for 5 issues?
I think, because don't we have 5 chapters here?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it must have. And I cannot remember. I think I got the first issue, but nothing after that. I don't know if the additional stories that we get at the very beginning and at the very end were a part of that series. Because this first piece, which is called A Preface, is by Paul Pope, which is pretty cool. Anything by Paul Pope is great.
Right, right. And then we have the epilogue, I guess, that's by... let's see, who is it? Alex Zurt and have my paper.
Alexis Zurt and Chris Hunt, yeah.
Yeah, Alexis Zurt and Chris Hunt. So
Vasai Morir.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, is that, I guess, the epilogue.
Yeah, and then in between those two things is the five chapters of Chris Hunt's Carver proper. And so that preface by Paul Pope does set, set some of the conventions and concepts that the series will be dealing with. Carver is set in 1923, and in this preface, Carver's at a music hall and he ends up hanging out with a mysterious figure who he's basically a confidant, who gives him some advice, who then does reappear later on in the book. And this person is Italian, right? and looks a lot like Cordo Maltese.
Right. Now, you may not think that he looks much of anything like Cordo Maltese in the Paul Pope preface, but then when we get to the 5th chapter in this trade, what would have been the 5th issue, then we see him, and yeah, that is Cordo Maltese.
That's interesting you say that, because I pegged it right away.
Oh, the Paul Pope's preface?
Yeah, yeah.
The completely bearded Corto?
Yeah.
Huh.
There may have been something he said or something he, but like when he, in the, I don't know, third page of this 3-page preface, he jumps off the building and he's got, you know, the Cordo hat in his hand.
Oh, I see that.
He's not wearing it on his head, but, and so that's, I think, one of the things that doesn't give it away if he were wearing that hat and if he were better shaved. But Carver does say to him too, "I like the beard," and he responds, "I've grown lazy, or else I am in disguise, your choice."
Right.
So it also cues us to the fact that he's not normally wearing the beard. But the other thing is that I feel like, especially on that third page, that Pope's style shifts enough that it does look like he's drawing in Hugo Pratt's style. Mm. Now, I'm also maybe more cued to this too, because in my Black Hawk sketchbook, Paul Pope, who was at a conference I was at Ohio State a few years ago, grabbed my sketchbook and paged through it and then started drawing in it, and he drew Cordo Maltese in my Blackhawk sketchbook, I guess. So
maybe that's why you were prone to see this character as Cordo Maltese early on.
Right. And then Paul Pope signed it Hugo Pratt. and so now every time I give somebody my sketchbook, they page through it and they go, how did you get a sketch from Hugo Pratt? And I have to explain, no, that's not Hugo Pratt. Or so others will figure it out. I mean, I think, someone got the sketchbook and they were looking at it, and Chris Schweitzer it was, and he's like, the timeline doesn't work here. You've got sketches from people who weren't in comics until after Hugo Pratt died. So he figured it out, but others didn't. So anyway, maybe it was wishful thinking on my part too that ended up getting paid off. So though that is one of the more interesting aspects of this book, and then he does again show up later, and probably his identity becomes a little clearer then as well.
Not ambiguous at all. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, looking at that third page of the Paul Pope preface, mm-hmm. Wow, I was alliterative right there. Mm-hmm. You know, I do see the hat. I didn't notice it at first, but, you know, even at this angle, it's not entirely clear that this is the kind of hat that Cordo would have worn. Although, the pants, now that I look closely, they do look bell-bottom.
Yep. Yeah. So if he's in disguise with the beard, he hasn't changed anything else about himself. He's got the same outfit, the same scarf. Yeah. But anyway. So that, again, that is one of the more interesting things that goes on in this book, this idea that that Carver has somehow intersected with Cordo Maltese. And this story being set in 1923, I kind of hope to see maybe more of that, that kind of pastiche of pulp characters and other comics, figures that, you know, were in that are set in a 1920s milieu. I think that could have made this book fun, though. Of course, there's already a lot of stuff that does that.
Right. You know, another thing about this preface by Pope is that not only do we see a bearded Cordo Maltese, but we also see Josephine Baker, that's one of the things I found interesting in not just the preface but the entire collection, Carver, A Paris Story, is that the way that Hunt is mixing in actual historical figures with these more fictional or legendary characters. So, you know, Cordo Maltese, a legendary fictional character, Josephine Baker, an actual historical figure. We also see for two or three panels F. Scott Fitzgerald.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, he only goes by the name Scott, though, but, you know, you can read between the lines there. So we do get that historical figure, but even more interesting in terms of both historical and legendary figures is the character that we're introduced when the book proper opens, and that is Stacker Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at first I was intrigued by the character Stacker Lee. And the way that Stacker introduces himself, and this is on the first page of this first chapter, it looks as if, and I assume he may be, although he doesn't have to be, addressing us directly as readers. But he could be addressing someone else as he's speaking. But it looks like he's addressing us as readers at first. He says, "Pardon me, as I was saying, I suppose it's time to introduce myself. My name is Stacker Lee, and I'm the one holding you here against your will." And so At first I thought, okay, well, what Hunt is doing is starting right off with a metafictional move there.
Mm-hmm.
Then you turn the page, he says, "Now I've got something of a reputation for being what's called a bad mother, and despite the circumstances appearing as what they are, I'm aiming to help you out of them if I can." So I think, okay, so this is the Stagger Lee type of character, right? And he's hooded throughout. So this guy is dressed in a, looks like a white, or it could be a light-colored suit, because this is a black-and-white comic. Mm-hmm. He wears a hat, but here he's holding it in his hand. But he's wearing a hood over his face.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't get to see who this character actually is, nor do we get to see what kind of person he is. But the role that he plays in the book, at least to me, seems to dissipate as the story continues. Now, we see him throughout in places, but that kind of entrance that he had at the very beginning of chapter one didn't have the same kind of impact on me as what we see happening in chapter five.
Right, right. He seems to be the crime boss.
Mm-hmm.
In this place, and they're in Paris, right?
Right.
Kind
of an inept crime boss.
Yeah. And so, you know, the fact that he refers to himself as a bad mother in that first first panels he appears in makes it then seem like we are dealing with the legendary. Stacker Lee or Stagger Lee or whatever name he goes by.
Mm-hmm.
which is interesting in a way, because the original Stagger Lee that we know of from, say, you know, Derek McCullough and Shepard Hendrix's graphic novel about the history was in had his he killed Billy Lyons in 1895 in St. Louis, and then went to jail soon after and died in jail. So if there is some explanation about how that Stagger Lee got to Paris to become a crime boss, we don't see that, at least in this issue. And in fact, I don't want to give a spoiler away, but when we do see the kind of identity of him behind, you know, what he looks like, I guess, not under his mask, and his relationship to Carver,
woman that
prior
he was
to this,
with. Right?
Yeah, prior to this, we don't. It doesn't seem like it could be. It could be the original Stagger Lee, unless there is something happens where the legend of Stagger Lee is different from the reality of it in this world, in the world of this comic. So, you know, maybe he escaped from jail and made his way to Paris, where he became a great crime boss. We don't know that, but there's enough references to that legend in here and the way he talks that I got the impression we're supposed to believe that this is that person and not just somebody who took on that name.
Yeah. Well, that's what I feel mixed about. I'm not entirely sure if it is the legendary figure or if it's someone taking on that name.
Right.
And it is ambiguously woven, especially at the end. And again, we don't want to give anything away. And so there may be more to this story that we see in future Carver stories, because as the last page of this collection states, Carver will return.
Right.
So I'm assuming that some of these questions that both of us have about not only, you know, who this Stacker Lee character is and what his relationship is to the historical figure, but how does he figure into Carver's world, and also just more about Carver, because there's a lot about the character Carver, who is the central focus here, that we don't know about. I mean, this is our introduction to Carver. We get a little of his backstory. We know that he was in World War One, and he what was the famous battle that he was in? I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember.
But it really affected him. He ends up massacring some Germans at one point, and he becomes legendary for that. And the assumption is that Carver, as we know him in 1923, is the way he is because of that experience. I'm intrigued by that, but I'd like a little more information about how this affected him and he became the man that he is. Now, if we're going to get more Carver stories, then I expect that to play out in future narratives. But so that's intriguing. But I don't know a lot about Carver from this first narrative arc. And there's also a lot that I don't know about the people in his world. I mean, we learn a little about his past love interest, Catherine. But then a big mystery to me is this bearded dude who wants to hire Carver. We're not exactly sure why, but his way of, I guess, seeing if Carver is up to the work is by putting his life gravely in danger.
Right.
We know nothing about this guy outside of the fact that, you know, he dresses fairly well.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I think that there's maybe a lot to be developed later on. If this series continues beyond these five issues, or if we get maybe other graphic novels later. But you're right, there's a lot of mystery going on. But basically what we know is that Carver seems to be a bad dude, you know, or badass dude who's who's a legendary killer. There's a point in which early on, when in a scene with between Cordo Maltese and the character you've identified as F. Scott Fitzgerald, where Cordo Maltese says, that you're romanticizing, because Fitzgerald is asking about Carver, and is this the legendary Francis Carver? And Cordo Maltese says, you're romanticizing this. We're just killers. And you're making us, part of a kind of black and white representation of morality when that is not the case. And so that seems to be a kind of thesis statement for the Carver character there, that we're meant to not be dealing with conventional notions of heroes and morality and so on in this book. We're going to be dealing with somebody that's more complex than that. And I think that's likely the case with Carver. It's also, I think, the case with a lot of other characters in this book, some of whom make kind of sharp turns in their personality as the story goes along.
Like Stacker Lee.
Yes.
Yeah. And in fact, that scene that you mentioned that kind of problematizes this idea of the hero, where Cordo is talking with F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Right.
He does mention here that it's the Belleau Wood. It was that battle that Carver earned his reputation. But what you just described in terms of problematizing the hero leads me to a question for you. When you were reading Carver, A Paris Story, every time you looked at the character Carver, could you not help but think of Ernest Hemingway?
That's interesting. I think I got a Hemingway vibe at first. I also couldn't help but think of Chris Schweitzer, but because Chris Schweitzer has the mustache and often, has that, wears the kind of anachronistic clothing as well. So I had that stuck in my head. I see what you're getting at.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking, you know, it takes place in Paris, the 1920s. We have references to other expatriate culture,
right.
Fitzgerald, Baker, with the mustache that Carver has when he's in mm-hmm. Paris, because he didn't have it when he was fighting
right.
in the war. It looks like a Hemingway mustache. Mm-hmm. You know, this whole emphasis on a hero not being really a hero, or what we call a hero is not
right.
really heroic, you know, is very much a Hemingway-esque stance. So, I don't know, he's not Hemingway, but I couldn't help but think of Hemingway.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if I were asking Chris Hunt about this book, that's one of the first questions I would ask is,
yeah.
did the character Carver come from Ernest Hemingway, your appreciation mm-hmm. or love of Ernest Hemingway?
Yeah, yeah.
Because this is like I don't want to call it a crime-fighting Ernest Hemingway. Because, I mean, yeah, he does fight crime, but he doesn't go out and try to fight crime. Crime comes to him.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Mm. But it's an interesting book, and I think that this series will resonate more with me when we have more Carver stories to really flesh out this world. Because it seems that Chris Hunt has quite a bit in mind for Carver.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and that the final story in this, the little epilogue that Alexis Zirit did with Chris Hunt, I think points to some potential in this, because, well, it's meant to be, I guess, a story that appears in a Carver pulp or comic, maybe even
mm-hmm.
that Carver's reading, and he's fighting a luchador and I don't know, a female demon of some kind, and then a monster shows, and she turns into a monster, and he kills her grotesquely with a machine gun, that kind of thing. That's what I would hope would be more of what Carver ends up being as the series progresses, just kind of this kind of out of control, fun book that mashes up all this different stuff like that. That last story was, you know, it's only three pages or so, but that's a lot of fun. And I kind of wish that we would have seen more of that in the book proper. And I hope that's ends up being a direction the series goes.
Yeah, because the tone is vastly different from, you know, the main story, Carver, a Paris story. So
right.
who knows which direction Hunt will take Carver in mm-hmm. for the next narrative arc. But, you know, we should also say that when we were talking on the mic before we turned the mic on, I guess,
mm-hmm.
that there's more to this book that we could say about issues of race. But we're not entirely sure. I'm not entirely sure what to make of race in this book, especially as it applies to the Stacker Lee character.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that may be something to flesh out more once we get into other Carver stories.
Yeah. Especially if these characters we see outside of Carver himself get picked up on later on. Because I think there's a lot of potential for this series.
Right.
You know, there's the literary references. There's the references to, you know, other comics, and so I would hope that maybe as the series progresses, it can tap into that potential a little more. Maybe not so much becoming, say, like a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen set in the 1920s, but something that does have this kind of fun element of pastiche to it that exploits that potential more.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the next title that we're going to be looking at this week, and this is Angel City, issue number 1. This is written by Janet Harvey and drawn by Megan Levins. Mm-hmm. It came out last month from Oni Press.
Right, right. And, you know, before we delve into this too deeply, one of the things I was struck by overall in our kind of reading of crime comics that have come out lately, and I've been, you know, you and I are both thinking about crime comics in other ways as well, in terms of scholarship. But one of the things I noticed in reading these books is how they're kind of like a handful of noir stories. And so what the creators end up doing with those, how do they twist those enough to make them original? Without also, you know, kind of breaking the genre in doing so. What kind of twists are available on those plots, especially since some of these plots have been recycled so many times? Those were kind of questions I saw as we went along, because I think with Angel City, as well as with some of the other stuff we're going to talk about, especially the two hard case crime books, Trigger Man and Peepland, these are very familiar plots.
Right.
But I don't think that necessarily takes away from the quality of the books. And I think Angel City is doing something really interesting with a plot that's almost basically the Black Dahlia.
Right. Yeah. it takes place. We don't know exactly when, but I read the setting, the temporal setting, as the, you know, the 1940s.
Right.
You know, soon after the Second World War, which is, you know, when the actual historical Black Dahlia crime was committed, as we'll discuss soon. You know, another thing that you said reminds me, and maybe we can start next week's show, the second in this recent crime comics look, by discussing this more fully. And that is, when we talk about crime comics, that can include a lot of different things. Now right. You mentioned the noir element in Angel City, and I think that most of the books that we're looking at, most of the titles this week and into next week, you could easily classify as noir. But not all of them. You know, we also tend to think that many crime comics are also detective narratives or narratives of detection. But again, that's not necessarily the case. And so there are a lot of subtleties and nuances when it comes to crime comics. And, you know, maybe next week, before we get into deep reading of the titles, we can flesh out some potential definitions or working definitions. Because tonally, what we find in Angel City, Trigger Man, and Moonshine, vastly different from what we'll see in The Fix.
Right, right. Yeah.
And not just because of the humor.
No, right. But I think The Fix is already doing, I mean, right out of the gate, Nick Spencer and Steve Lieber are playing around with our expectations of the crime genre and just messing with them completely. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about that book. But basically, you know, with Angel City, it's a pretty simple twist. That is that we have, you know, we have the dead ingenue. This time she's found in a dumpster instead of, you know, bisected in a field, like the Black Dahlia. But, And then we're introduced then to the main character, who is what's her name? Dolores Dare.
Right.
And she's kind of reluctantly drawn into investigating this mystery, but she herself is not. I mean, she was an aspiring actress at one time who ended up then working for the mob, basically, as a kind of enforcer. And her skill as an enforcer comes not just because she's a really good fighter and she's ruthless, but also that nobody kind of believes that she would be a threat at all.
Exactly, yeah. And, yeah, that's the twist that you had mentioned earlier. And you're right, it does begin very similar to not only the story of the Black Dahlia, but many other crime or noir narratives set in this time. Very similar. In fact, when a guy by the name of Joe, I guess he's a photographer, journalist, and he goes to see Dolores, and we see her at the door of her apartment. I mean, when I first saw this, I thought, okay, well, maybe she is an actress. In other words, she seems to be of means. because, I mean, she's sitting by a pool. She has a drink in her hand. She has her bathing suit on. In other words, this is not someone who is down and out. You know, this is not someone who comes to town and within the first few days, you know, can't find work, uses all her money, and then has to end up making money however she can, you know, regardless of the ethics. Now, as we read on, we do learn that she was in this predicament, but she becomes involved with the local mob, and that's why she's in the situation that she's in right now when we first see her. So, I mean, I do find that that's a very interesting twist. But the story we get, you know, the woman who dies at the very beginning is Frances Fay, and we learn through flashback from Dolores that she – Dolores met Frances on the bus. They came into Los Angeles together. They both had similar dreams. They wanted to get into acting, of course, like many women or people who came to Los Angeles at the time, especially. And whereas Frances Fay was idealistic to the end, which may, we don't know yet, be the cause of her undoing, Dolores is much more of a realist. And in fact, her real name is Dorothy Dunkel. But then she changes her name when she's asked by Gino Volante, who is the crime boss, if she would consider a job for him. She takes on the name Dolores Deer, which, you know, it's a great crime name.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And so I like what you said about kind of describing her, especially her situation, because, you know, when we think of the type of crime novels and movies that are set in this kind of milieu, you know, we're often dealing with a private detective who is down and out, right? Who's living from paycheck to paycheck. Dolores isn't like that. She has a comfortable living working for the mob, and so she's also already in this kind of moral twilight as it stands. I mean, she has a code that she follows. There's one point where some corrupt cops, for example, tell her, you know, we could use you. And she said, I'd rather be an honest gangster than a corrupt cop or something. I'm paraphrasing.
Right.
So that she does follow a code. She even follows a code with her boss.
Oh, yeah.
Romances her, gives her gifts, and these things make her uncomfortable. She doesn't want that. So that idea of kind of the gangster with a code is also, again, a common enough thing in noir stories. But in this case, I think it adds some depth to this character. So we're not getting the typical hard-boiled detective. But she is hard boiled. We're not getting the typical ruthless, immoral gangster. We're getting something that, and we're not getting the kind of sweet, innocent ingenue who's broken down by the Hollywood system.
Right.
And so I think that a lot of the success of this first issue of Angel City rides on this really interesting characterization of Dolores Deer. And I really do want to keep reading this for that reason.
Right. I do as well. And one of the things that I really appreciate that both Harvey and Levins do in representing Dolores Deer is that they don't really sexualize her, or they definitely don't over-sexualize her, which they could have done, you know, when the cops try to corrupt her, and especially when her boss Gino comes onto her. Had she succumbed in even a slight way, that would have added a dimension of her that I think wouldn't have worked as well. But I think it really builds her character that she does have, as you were mentioning, this code that she does live by. Even though there's a part of her that I think regrets not being the kind of idealistic individual that her dead friend Frances was. But again, she's enough of a realist to know that, you know, that really can't be the case. Another thing that I appreciated about this first issue is, you know, we were talking about common tropes in noir narrative. Fairly early on, we get the flashback, right? So when this young guy, Joe, goes to see Dolores to tell her that, you know, their friend Frances has, you know, been found dead in a dumpster behind Grauman's Chinese Theater. Then that's when we get this flashback. And, you know, Levins illustrates this in such a way that the colors are toned down. So it's like a sepia tone throughout. So we definitely know that it's a flashback. And the way that it's handled, though, doesn't strike me, this flashback, as heavy-handed. It's represented through almost like a series of photographs, right? So the panels become the photographs that we get the backstory of not only Frances Fay, who's been murdered, but also Dorothy, who eventually becomes Dolores. And, you know, it really sets up her character. So I think that, you know, again, as you pointed out, Harvey's dealing with a well-trod territory when it comes to this kind of story. But I think she gives the elements like this flashback just enough of a twist to where it becomes, if not new, then definitely interesting and enjoyable. And it works with the overall package.
Right, right. That flashback, especially the part where Dorothy, and when she's still Dorothy, is working as a cigarette girl in the club, and she stands up for herself against a guy who harasses her.
Mm-hmm.
Now that scene exists in other noir stories, and usually the outcome for the woman who stands up for herself in that way is that she ends up getting fired at best, beaten up by her boss, or even killed by the person that she's embarrassed in public. Very, very rarely does it turn out the way it turns out for Dorothy here, where she ends up getting a job out of it,
right?
A new job out of it. But it is a good twist that empowers this character in a way that we see her heading in a trajectory that follows certain expectations of this genre, and then it turns,
right?
And it turns into this way in this really interesting way. So, when I first read the solicit for Angel City, I thought it was interesting in and of itself that we have an all female creative team that is creating a female driven noir. And what I really find that pays off in this is that they're dealing with the conventions and stereotypes of women in noir and messing with them.
Right. Exactly. And that's the key to this, right? Mm-hmm. Taking the conventions, taking the formulas and icons of this particular genre and presenting them in a way that is definitely not hackneyed.
Right.
Yeah. So like you, I'm going to go on and read the next issues of Angel City.
Yes.
So let's move on to the next title that we're going to be looking at, and this is Moonshine Number 1, published through Image Comics, the first issue of which came out in October. And this is by a fairly impressive creative team, Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Risso.
Right, so we're getting the team behind 100 Bullets returning to the crime genre, but again, doing something with a twist.
Yeah, now I remember when this was solicited, and you and I were pointing this out in our preview show a few months ago, and I think, if I remember correctly, we were a little cautious where we were looking forward to it, but we were wondering if this may be just taking what they did in 100 Bullets and setting it in the early part of the 20th century, and this takes place in 1929. Right. But then when we got review copies of not only the first issue, but the first three issues, they were unedited issues, we saw something a little bit different. So this is definitely not a retelling of the kind of story you would find in 100 Bullets. It's very different than that.
No. And, you know, I am really glad that we got the first three issues because I think that you do see, you know, where this series is going, but also I liked the first issue a lot. I have been kind of cooled to Brian Azzarello's work in particular in recent years, especially, you know, kind of after 100 Bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a little hesitant about this series, but I did like these first three issues a lot. I liked the first issue in particular, and so I'll probably stick with this. I may stick with it in trade, just because, you know, I've seen the first three issues already, but I think it is definitely worth sticking with.
Yeah. Now, I don't know how much to talk about what happens after issue number one, because issue number two, that comes out pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not exactly sure when. I guess I should have looked that up. And then issue three won't be out until December. So we definitely don't want to tease that far into the future. But if, you know, if we limit ourselves to just issue number one, then this does seem to be more of a traditional crime story. But then once we get into issue number two, it begins to take on a supernatural feel, or at least a little more of a supernatural feel. And I think that that becomes even more prominent in issue number three.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that this first issue does a really good job of setting up everything. I mean, when we open issue one, we get, what, three federal agents in the backwoods of West Virginia. And again, the temporal setting's 1929. And they're looking for the still of, oh God, what's the guy's name? Holt, Hiram Holt.
Yeah,
apparently he has a famous still somewhere hidden in the mountains. And then they find it, and, you know, of course, they have their axes. They're going to, you know, chop it all up and beat it to crap, and they have guns. But then they hear something, and we don't know what this is, but whatever force, creature, animal, whatever, attacks the federal agents, does a hell of a bloody job.
Right.
And, you know, if we limit ourselves to this first issue, we'd be teased by those opening pages, but not really know much of anything mm-hmm. about what those federal agents saw when they found Hiram still.
Yeah, and so I'm glad though that those pages are there, because
they do
tease that that we may have some supernatural horror elements possibly mm-hmm. that and you know, we did see in the solicit. It did mention something about that as well.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, the issue follows this gangster named Lou Pirlo, who is working for the boss, Joe Masseria, who wants to import north this fantastic hooch that Hiram Holt makes.
Right. Very, very smooth.
Yeah. And so that is the impetus for the plot here is that the boss sends Lou down to West Virginia to make a deal.
Right.
And Lou shows up in this small town, sticking out quite a bit in his double-breasted suit and fedora. And
his cafe ordering habits.
Yeah, right. and he ends up with, with the Holt family, and as the story progresses, we discover that nothing is straightforward with this family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I love about not only this first issue, but into the next two issues as well, is the character of Lou Pirlo.
Right.
Because he's someone who, I mean, he is a gangster figure, but he's not, let's say, a stereotypical gangster figure. I mean, he's one who's very complicated. There's a side of him that, I mean, not only is softer than you would think, but is also much less confident than you'd think.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And much of this is brought about by his drinking problem.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are other things that go on as well. So So, for instance, and I think it's it, we get a little bit of information of this in the first issue. There's a part of his history when he was a kid that has left some kind of mark on him, and that is when he made a makeshift boat mm-hmm. when he was a kid from the wood that his father brought from work. And he went out, I guess, into the East River with it, and his sister wanted to take the boat out. And when his sister did, he tells us that she did the one thing he told him not to do, and that was stand up in the, you know, unsteady right. boat. And when he went out to save her, that was a seminal moment for him. Now, this appears again in another issue, but I get the sense that this event in his past is going to have a big part in defining, maybe at least in the first narrative arc, what we see of the character Lou.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And yeah, and I think there's going to be an interesting parallels that Azarel and Russo are going to draw between Lou's drinking problem and you know, the other elements that are going on. You know, the fact that he gets, you know, blackout drunk and doesn't remember things that happened, and kind of turns into a kind of monster when he's drunk, that's out of control. So I think there's a lot of potential there,
right.
for this. One of the other things I wanted to mention is that I was really happy, at least in these first three issues, that that Azzarello's punning was kept to a minimum, because the title itself, Moonshine, is already a pun,
right?
And so one of the things that kind of drives me nuts about his work that I thought initially in 100 Bullets was really clever, but then when everybody in the story was doing it, is the way he uses puns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, another thing about the character Lou that I really appreciate is the fact that, I mean, this is someone who is situated between two forces, two unsteady mm-hmm. forces. You know, there's his boss, Joe Mazzaria, who is unrealistic in his demands. And then there is Hiram Holt and the mystery surrounding him and his family.
Right.
Again, another unpredictable, mm-hmm. unstable element. And so how is he going to negotiate those two unsteady forces? But then at the very end of issue number one, another force, another culture comes mm-hmm. into play,
right?
Because as Lou is leaving Hiram's place, he's driving at night and he has a flat tire, you know, deep in the mm-hmm. woods. And mm-hmm. so as he's trying to, I guess, walk and find some help, he overhears some music in the distance. And when he goes toward the music, he sees this small African-American community, seems small, African-American community, and they're sitting around a fire. You know, one of them's playing a banjo. A couple of others are playing instruments or, you know, banging on some kind of percussion and dancing, and they're having a good time. And then when he walks into the light, they stop what they're doing, and they look at him, and, you know, the guy playing the banjo says, "You want something, mister?" Mm-hmm. And then Lou says, "A drink, for starters." And, of course, he looks at an African-American woman who is, of course, you know, I mean, this is, you know, Russo here. So, you know, she looks sexy. You can see her cleavage. She's sweating. This is Delia, and we'll find out her name, I think, in the second issue. No, the third issue.
Yeah.
And so this is how that first issue ends. I think that's a great tease, and I'm curious to see how Azzarello is going to handle this African-American community and what it may represent. But what I'm afraid of, what I hope does not happen, is that he uses this in some kind of almost predictable way where, you know, they have something to do with the supernatural element, that there's something about the culture of the other that breeds this kind of hoodoo. And, you know, we see this all the time with not only African Americans, but many times in comics with Native Americans, right? So, you know, this kind of tapping into the reality beyond that which we see and experience normally is something that only the Native American other can do. And I think we see something similar going on sometimes with other communities. I'm just hoping that that's not where Azzarello is going to be going with Moonshine.
Yeah, I agree on that completely, and I like the way you explained that, because I do think, you know, as much as I like 100 Bullets, for example, I think there's elements of it that are racially problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm always tentative, I think, about the way Azzarello handles those situations and plots. He doesn't, you know, he certainly doesn't shy away from them. But what, you know, what I am really hoping for here is kind of what you were alluding to there, that there's enough that we're seeing already that's playing with conventions and stereotypes and so on, that he is setting up what's going to look like a stereotype, but then take it in a different direction.
Right, and I hope he does. Now, on the topic of stereotypes, and I don't think this is apparent so much in the first issue, but in 2, and I think definitely issue number 3, again, which we'll anticipate in December, there's something about Riso's art that at times strikes me as a little racially charged. The way that he draws, and I think in the Moonshine series, a few of the African American characters, especially some of the younger kids, the way that he draws their face, their lips, their eyes, their jaws, I don't know. That bothers me at times. And I think part of that is part of Eduardo Risso's style, because he draws a lot of people in a somewhat similar way. I just think that when he turns his style, when he applies his style to certain minority communities, you know, primarily in this case African American, it tends to get a bit stereotyped. Or to suggest that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to put this nicely.
So I think I think that there's some interesting pitfalls that this series has to navigate as it goes along. Now, one of the other things you mentioned earlier too about how Lou, you know, is working for this mob boss, but then he's also getting involved in this this family in West Virginia and with the Holtz, also reminds me of another work that seems to have some influence on some of the things we're talking about today, which is Dashiell Hammett's Red Harvest. And that gangster narrative, that Prohibition era gangster narrative of the lone wolf who pits two sides against each other.
I'm
wondering if we're heading that direction with Lou as well, that, you know, he's seeing opportunities here to pit the Holtz against his boss's crime family. You know, that plot is also a common gangster and I think other genre plot. I mean, it's the plot of Akira Kurosawa's Yojimbo. It's the plot of A Fistful of Dollars. And it's the plot of Miller's Crossing and a couple other movies. So I'm curious to see how that influence plays out in this series as well.
Yeah. But this is definitely something I want to keep up with.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember, is this, as of now, at least an ongoing?
Yeah. I don't think it's been announced as a mini series. I have a feeling it'll be, you know, it'll probably be something like, maybe probably not as ambitious as 100 Bullets by any means, but
there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah. I mean, this could be a series that builds and builds.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be fine with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, as well it should. Mm-hmm. Well, the next two titles we're going to be discussing, I guess we can look at together if you want. They're both published through Titan Comics, and they're both part of the Hard Case Crime series. Now, a few months ago, you and I were talking on a preview show about how Titan had not too long ago acquired the rights to the Hard Case Crime Pro series.
Right.
And some of the people who are writing for this new comic series have contributed to, you know, the earlier prose Hard Case Crime books. But the two titles that we're looking at now, Trigger Man number one, which came out on October 5th, the first issue. Now, the original story is by Walter Hill, but it's adapted by Matz and with art by Jeff. And then Peepland number one, written by Krista Faust and Gary Phillips with art by Andrea Camerini.
Mm-hmm.
And this came out October 12th. Now, Trigger Man number one takes place in Arizona in the year 1932,
right.
And Peepland in New York, the seamier side of New York, in 1986. And in fact, there's only one narrative we're looking at this week that takes place in contemporary times, and that is The Fix. Everything else is set in a previous time. So Peepland 1986, Trigger Man 1935, as we'll talk about in a moment, the true story of Black Dahlia, 1947, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Moonshine 1929, Angel City the 1940s, it seems, and then Carver 1923.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a historical romp.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, you know, one of the reasons why I mentioned Red Harvest with Moonshine is because Walter Hill is also a filmmaker who's adapted the Red Harvest plot before,
mm-hmm.
which is in his movie Last Man Standing with Bruce Willis, which is set in the same 1930s, late 20s, early 30s prohibition milieu.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like that movie. That movie gets, I think, critically lambasted, but I like what he's doing because Walter Hill is a filmmaker I like a lot, who tends to play around with genre conventions so much that it often turns off viewers and critics. He did a film version of the Wild Bill Hickok story, for example, with Jeff Bridges as Wild Bill, that got, you know, critically beaten to death. But when I watched it, I really liked it because I could see where he was playing around with our expectations of what a Western should be, mm-hmm. Especially in dealing with a real life figure. So I'm looking forward to seeing how Trigger Man builds on the conventions of of the gangster crime story, which is where this falls in.
Mm-hmm. So the original story from Walter Hill, but it's adapted by Matz, and mm-hmm. you know, Matz's real name is Alexis Noland, and we were talking about him a number of weeks ago with another adapted work, The Black Dahlia, based on the James Ellroy story, which is based on the actual historical mm-hmm. Black Dahlia case, which again we'll discuss next. But, you know, Matz is also the creator behind the Killer series.
Right.
And so this is someone who definitely knows his crime narrative.
Yeah, exactly. And that makes, you know, when I was reading The Killer recently on your recommendation, and another thing that The Killer reminded me of is the classic Euro Comics crime series, Torpedo.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
and I think even this is even more Trigger Man is even more Torpedo like because it's actually set in that same world as well. So I wonder how much of that influence we're going to see here as well. I think it's also worth noting that Trigger Man is a reprint of a previously published work that was published in France in 2015.
Mm. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because it allows us to point out that the translator of this issue, and I guess in all subsequent ones of this series, is our friend and co-host Edward Govan. He co-hosts the Eurocomics monthly series with me. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I read this, I got in touch with him to ask him about, you know, what he may have to tell me insider-wise about the translation of this. Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't tell me much of anything because he was currently flying out to France for a brief residency. But he did say, wow, that's just coming out now. And I asked him what he meant by that, and he said that he translated that quite a while ago. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't even know that this first issue of Trigger Man was even out. He just assumed that it had already come out.
I wonder then if this indicates something about what Titan is doing, which is that that Trigger Man is a work that they, you know, they got previously prior to developing the Hard Case Crime series. And once they decided to do the Hard Case Crime series, they just folded this already planned comic into it.
Yeah. And along with that, you know, knowing that this, you know, was originally a European publication, it does make sense, because Jeff's art, and we mentioned that the author's name is Jeff, and that's J-E-F, and he's one of those creators that only goes by that name, right? Mm-hmm. But his art is strikingly different from the style of Andrea Camerini, who does Peepland. And, you know, Camerini's art, okay, if I had to look at the art of Peepland next to Trigger Man, and you would ask me what were the rough geographic derivations of the artist, I would say that there's something about Camerini's art that seems American, and there's something about Trigger Man's art that just strikes me as more European album-like.
Hmm. No.
Because, I mean, Jeff's art does have that feel to it. It's a little more, or a lot more, realistically rendered. And it is something that I think is more common in European comic art than we would find in most, I think, current American comics.
Hmm. Yeah. So I should probably mention something about the plot. we are following
the Trigger Man.
The Trigger Man, whose name is Roy, who arrives in this tiny Arizona town, basically to collect a debt, it looks like, but ends up performing a hit on the owner of a local bar who owes Roy's bosses money. The whole scene at the beginning of the book where he enters the bar and tries to tries to find out where the owner is a pretty tense scene, and I think Jeff does a good job of building the tension, so much so that, for example, when Roy pulls out the machine gun and starts firing in the bar, that I had to go back and look to see where that machine gun came from, because it wasn't apparent to me immediately while I was reading where it came from. And then I looked back and I saw how effectively he's building the tension by having Roy has his suitcase basically sitting on a stool next to him at the bar, and he's very slowly opening the suitcase from panel to panel as this conversation is not getting him where he needs to go. Mm-hmm. With bringing out the bar's owner.
Right, and it's a classic era Tommy gun.
Yeah, and he ends up being pretty ruthless about it. But then as he's leaving, a young lady who is in the bar... who's a witness to this, comes out and asks him for a ride to L.A., and so they end up traveling together, and that's kind of where this... Where this ends up. So they're traveling together, and then we get a flashback towards the end of how Roy ended up on this assignment in the first place, which is a pretty interesting plot twist as well.
Yeah, You know, I mean, there are three parts to this first issue, and you've just highlighted all three. You know, there's that opening scene, which is quite intense, the hit, or what eventually becomes a hit. Then there's the much briefer hotel room scene with the woman Rose Malone, mm-hmm. that he picks up. And, you know, I don't know if this relationship is going to build much beyond what we see in this first issue. You know, she's using him to get what she wants or where she's going to go, and he's going to basically use her just for pleasure, and that's it. But then the third element is this flashback scene that takes place at Joliet Prison, and that's where a lot of the questions from this first issue arise. Mm-hmm. And it's intriguing because we know that, you know, Roy's in prison, and he's called by the guards to witness some kind of scene that he doesn't know what to make sense of, and we don't know really what's going on. It involves more Tommy guns, and I don't think this is a spoiler, they're asking him to get Roy Nash, they're asking him to get in a coffin,
mm-hmm.
and that's basically how this first issue ends.
Right.
So, I mean, this is, I think, an outstanding way to end this first issue, because it definitely has me wanting to come back to see, you know, what's next. I mean, I think that Peepland number one ends in a very good place as well. I just think that Triggerman number one, mm-hmm. is a punch in the gut.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like that was a good transition into Peepland.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah. And so Peepland is written, as you mentioned earlier, by Gary Phillips and Krista Faust. Krista Faust having had a couple books already out from the Hard Case Crime series, Chokehold and Money Shot, which are two books that I really like. I was curious to see what she would be doing with Peepland. And again, going back to something I said earlier, Peepland starts us with a pretty conventional noir plot. There, someone has witnessed a crime, and the evidence that person has is now out in the open, and people are looking for it, and someone who was absolutely not involved in the crime, kind of an innocent bystander, has picked up that evidence and is now going to be implicated in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, we see that a lot. That's kind of, you know, the plot of, for example, Brian De Palma's Blowout. Mm-hmm. But it's also set in, as you mentioned, the New York in the 1980s, when Times Square was completely not Disneyfied.
No.
Before
Giuliani.
Yeah. And at a time that a lot of people are nostalgic for, I don't know. I mean, I went to Times Square in the 80s when I was a kid, and it wasn't, I don't feel nostalgic for that at all, being, you know, 13 years old. But, you know, it was, there were a lot of smut shows there, and in fact, that's kind of where this story starts off, with a performer in one of these shows who ends up getting kind of caught up in this situation that she didn't choose to be in. Mm-hmm. But then we also get another character. We'll get several other characters who will probably figure into this as well, including a young woman who is named AJ, who is involved with her brothers in committing crimes.
The whole AJ story was an interesting twist in this first issue. I think that there's just enough there not to overpower the main storyline with Roxy, but it kind of hints and teases at what we could expect in the issues to come. So, it kind of adds a kind of narrative complexity to what this series will actually be, at least.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, and so Roxy is our main character. She's the one who strips in this peep club, and when we first see her, you know, she's naked, she's, you know, dancing for someone, you know, she has, you know, a big sexy wig on. And then as she is, I guess, right after she's finished up with her client, because she calls someone in to the room to clean up after him, that's when, you know, this guy with the camera, who is kind of a semi-celebrity, right? His name is Dirty Dick, and apparently his shtick is that he goes out in public with a camera, and he eventually tries to get people, I guess specifically women, to do things on camera. And so there's this kind of voyeuristic, erotic, you know, smut side to what he does. I mean, I guess that's specifically what he does. And he runs in. He's got something. He has a videotape. And for our young listeners who may wonder what that is, look it up on Wikipedia, a videotape. But, you know, he says to Roxy, "You got to hide this for me." And then he runs out, and there are people chasing him. And by the time we get to the end of this first issue with Roxy and her former, maybe current, we don't know yet, boyfriend Nick, when they look at this video, then they see a little bit of what Dirty Dick was worried about.
Yeah. And so in Krista Faust and Gary Phillips setting this story in this mid-80s milieu of, you know, New York City and the and Times Square in that period, they're also setting up a lot of stuff that's going on in the culture at the time. Roxy has an uncle who has AIDS. It's not specifically mentioned, but, you know, his symptoms seem to be clearly that. And so we're going to be dealing with that. We're going to be dealing with AJ with her, you know, issues with her sexuality and probably gender identity as well, that, you know, were much different culturally in the mid 80s than they are today, but also the whole kind of adult film industry, that a guy like Dirty Dick could, you know, because of the available technology of videotape and video cameras, was transforming the pornographic industry with these kind of gonzo films that, you know, didn't have a plot, didn't have a script, were done super cheaply, and how, you know, that turning point in that industry is based on that technology.
Yeah, and another, I guess, cultural moment from the 1980s that we get specifically through Roxy's, I don't know, former boyfriend Nick, and that is punk culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the last days, I guess, the last days of punk culture in New York in the 1980s.
Yeah, good. So, yeah, I'm curious to see where this is going, but I think that it's got some interesting stuff going on about it. You know, and you mentioned earlier about the time periods that these stories are set in. I think this is one that's really, really taking advantage of that 80s period. And, you know, it upsets me a little bit that was in my lifetime, but it was still 30 years ago. And, you know, but I was 17. So, you know, when this story is taking place. So the, you know, the fact that this is kind of ancient history now is, you know, and that you have to mention the younger listeners that there's a thing called videotape, or that that Times Square wasn't this kind of fantastic public place where you could go and see Broadway shows and
with your family.
yeah.
So now issues 2 of both Peepland and Triggerman should be coming out pretty soon,
right?
And we're also going to be getting, I guess, in January, the next series in the hard crime series from Titan, and that is Reassignment, and this is by the exact same creative team as Triggerman.
Yeah, yeah, and so since Triggerman has already been completed, it makes sense that this team could be working on another another series. So I'm curious to see how many hard case crime books Titan puts out at a time. Are they going to continue to do two, you know, 6-issue miniseries or whatever at a time, or are they going to do more than that, or one shots? Like, it seems like this next one might be, I don't know. So we'll see. But I like where they're starting out. I think it's consistent with the quality of the novels that Hard Case Crime has put out.
Right. Now, you were wondering if, Titan may limit itself to two, maybe tops three at a time that are out in the Hard Case comic series. If we use what Titan is doing with the Doctor Who property, then we may have multiple titles going on at the same time.
Sure. But then if we use what they're doing with the Hammer stuff, then we've only got one Hammer comic. So,
yeah.
So maybe there will be a happy medium between one and infinity.
Yeah. Well, let's move to the next title that we're looking at today, and that is Black Dahlia by Rick Geary. This is part of his Treasury of 20th Century Murder series, published by NBM, and this one came out the very beginning of November.
Right, and we've already talked about the adaptation of the James Ellroy novel that we saw recently, but this is... With most of Geary's stuff, you know, meticulously researched narrative that explores all the different, forensic details and paths that the investigation took, even though it ultimately ends up being unsolved.
Right. And, we've talked to Rick Geary twice. We've interviewed him twice on the podcast with books either in this series or the Victorian murder series.
Right.
Or with books about this or around it in some way or another. And he's always fun to talk with. And I don't know if him being such a great guest is one of the reasons why I found this one of the most enjoyable reads of this batch. I don't want to rank my enjoyment of the various titles we're discussing this week in a definitive way, but I will say that these last two titles that we're discussing this week are the two that I had the most fun reading, and for very different reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know... That's interesting you point that out, because the Black Dahlia story is something that, you know, it's been around a while. When I was a teenager, I really got into that whole kind of Hollywood Babylon stuff and reading these stories of the gruesome murders and crimes and other things that went on, you know, in the golden age of Hollywood. So I'd read James Ellroy's book back in the day. So it had been, well trod territory for me, but I still appreciate the approach that, that Geary takes to this, that, even in, something that I thought I knew very well, I felt like I learned something, but I also appreciated the way he kind of organized this into these different chapters that that break down the case in interesting ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so if you're familiar with Geary's Treasury of Victorian and then Treasury of 20th Century Murders, it's something very similar, right? So he takes a well-researched historical approach, and he lays out the narrative in a very engaging way. And you're right. I mean, you know, the story of the Black Dahlia, it's been around, you know, for since the 1940s, and it has been worked with in any number of ways since. But what Geary brings to the story is, I think, his own unique historical curiosity, mm-hmm. much like he did with, let's say, I mean, other books in the Victorian series. I mean, Lincoln's murder. Everybody knows about the assassination, right? But yet, Geary was able to write about it in a way that it didn't seem old hat, right? Mm-hmm. That he wasn't just merely giving us, you know, a comics rendition of the history behind the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And so we have something similar going on here. And you're right, he breaks this down into a variety of different chapters that take us chronologically and also even thematically through the murder and the case behind the murder, the investigation. So, I mean, I think this is it's interesting that this book came out just a few months after the adaptation of the Elroy book that Fitcher, Matz, and Hyman did.
Yeah, yeah, but I think it makes for an interesting companion to that. Mm-hmm. You know, and when I think back to when we interviewed him, you know, you mentioned the, you know, how the Lincoln assassination is well trod and so on. But, you know, like the Garfield assassination wasn't for me, you know, and so learning about that or learning about McKinley through his other works was really helpful and informative. Whereas I think here with the Black Dahlia, we're dealing with a story that is pretty well trod, but the, you know, the approach and the organization and so on of the information that he gives, I think fleshes this out in a way that other sources I've looked at haven't done as well. So I think anybody who's read Rick Geary's stuff before is going to find that this, you know, this follows along in the quality and level of interest that those books produce. And I would highly recommend it.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think he does that really fleshes out this story is we get a lot of detail of the many people in Elizabeth Short's life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and because we have friends that she was involved with, the various loves of or the relationships that she had, even engagement. So, I mean, there's a lot there to give you a really thick history behind this very famous murder. You know, which again in the recent adaptation of the McElroy novel is lightly touched upon, but understandably so. But here we get a deep dive into the history of the murder.
Right.
Yeah. So, and you know, I'm very glad that Geary is continuing to do this series. I can't remember the last time we had a book in the 20th Century Murder series. I think it was the Madison Square Tragedy from maybe 3 years ago. Mm. I know that last year, which is the last time we interviewed him, it was Wolverton and I think we interviewed him for Louise Brooks' Detective. Did you read that?
No.
Yeah, that was a very different twist to the kind of things that he's doing with his Treasury of, let's say, Victorian and 20th century murders, in that those books are, you know, anchored, rooted deeply in the history, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what they're all about. But with Louise Brooks, what Rick does is he takes the actual historical figure, the actress Louise Brooks, and he creates a fiction around her, making her into a detective, kind of an unwitting detective, which makes it a very fun story. And I wondered if this may be a route that he was going to take in subsequent work. But now we get this new story of the Black Dahlia. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that he's back with the Treasury.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to the last title that we're going to be discussing this week. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this is one of the ones that I had most fun with. And this is Nick Spencer and Steve Lieber's The Fix. And we're looking at the first trade, which came out in late September, which collects the first four issues. But we can also discuss the other two issues that have come out so far, numbers 5 and 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know, when I mentioned before, or I'm sure, so I got a chance to see Steve Lieber at CXC, which is where I picked up my copy of the trade and the other and issues 5 and 6. In fact, I got the trade, went to my hotel room and read it, and then the next day came and got issues 5 and 6. He nicely drew a sketch of a dog inside the front of the book. But in reading, I mean, I was laughing out loud when I was reading this book. It is a funny book, and I don't know if you read Nick Spencer and Steve Lieber's previous collaboration, The Superior Foes of Spider-Man.
No, I was going to ask if you had. Yeah. I heard that it was fun.
Yeah, it is. It is a blast, and it is a very similar approach to the narrative. That is, first, well, to character, getting you to sympathize with the criminals, mm-hmm. who are the main characters, but also Nick Spencer and Steve Lieber's narratives in that series, as well as this one, seem to be kind of constantly delaying, moving the plot forward in a sense, mm-hmm. that, you know, we've get, with the main characters, here are the two cops that we have, and specifically
Roy and Mac.
Yeah, Roy and Mac, and the narrator, and Roy, who narrates most of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
He constantly keeps kind of screwing up the way he wants to tell the story, so he has to flash back to other things, or he'll flash forward by accident and then have to backtrack. That is, I think, a part of one of the many things that I find to be a lot of fun in this book, is the narrative voice that he gives for Roy.
Yeah, that's a good point. I really enjoyed that aspect of these first 6 issues as well. I'm wondering, though, if that is a narrative device that Spencer is going to be able to maintain,
right,
as the series continues. I mean, right now we have no way of knowing how long the series, uh-huh, is going to go for. I mean, where they are in the story in the first 6 issues, and as you put it, there's kind of a delay in the action, and I think that's part of the fun. I mean, this could go on for a long time.
Right. Right.
But my guess is that as it continues, and maybe I'm wrong here, but I get a sense that we would get less of a first-person narration from Roy. Which would make sense, but, you know, who knows?
Right, but, for example, one of the things that is interesting and might be kind of frustrating to readers is that you see on all the covers how the dog is featured on almost every cover.
Mm-hmm.
And that would make you think that the dog is pretty central to the narrative, but he doesn't factor in all that much. When he does, it's great. It's hilarious,
yeah.
Especially when he catches the guy who's smuggling who's smuggling drugs in his nuts. But one might expect the dog to have a bigger central role than he does.
Right.
What
was the first issue? We didn't get to see the dog, Pretzels.
Right.
That's his name,
yeah.
Pretzels, until the last 2 panels.
Uh-huh.
But then even in the subsequent 3 issues that make up this first volume, we don't see him that frequently.
No, we don't.
Which I think adds more power to him as a character, or as a potential character, or an element that just moves things forward.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing him more. Now, one of the things I mentioned earlier in general and talking about the stuff we're talking about is how they play with genre tropes and conventions, and I think that's evident in The Fix more than in any of these others, because I think Spencer is being particularly self-conscious about it, and that's evident from the opening pages, where we get Roy narrating about, you know, the current state of being a criminal and how difficult it is, especially with the internet being the place where most successful crime takes place. And then we see the two characters robbing a retirement home. But as we're going along in these first pages, we assume that we're dealing with two career criminals, What we don't get is the twist a few pages in that they're the cops.
Right.
They're also criminals, but they're the cops, and then they end up being the cops who investigate the robbery of the retirement home, and Roy, being kind of the jerk that he is, keeps pushing things to the point that it becomes a risk that they're going to get caught as the thieves, and they don't, but he keeps messing around with it for his own entertainment.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned that at the very beginning, we think that these guys who are about to rob, an old folks home or retirement home are career criminals. But if they are career criminals, as we think they are at first, we see fairly quickly they're inept career criminals. So they haven't learned much. And I think that's part of the fun, or much of the fun of the fix, is whether as criminals or as police officers, I mean, these guys are rather inept.
Right. Yes.
And the best laid plans always go screwy.
Yeah. And well, I don't even know if their plans are ever best laid either. it's too complicated to even get into the plot about how Roy wants, is it Mac, his partner?
Yes.
Yeah. How Roy wants Mac to get hooked up with pretzels. That is such a complicated plot, plan, that the fact that it works is ridiculous.
Yeah. But actually, okay, that's linked to one of the most interesting characters to me, and that is Josh. You know, Josh is this kind of middle class, middle-aged father, he comes across as very almost yuppie-like in a way, right? He's the guy who would shop for organic food, who's very health conscious, who takes care of his family, works with the community, you know, does those kind of stereotypical things, really, of someone that you may think of as, you know, shopping at Whole Foods. But he's a ruthless killer, right? Mm. And we don't know exactly why, even after six issues, but Roy and Mac are into Josh. Mm-hmm. For money. Now we know why they lost, or at least some of the reason why they don't have much money. They go to what is the machine that they bid on Jizz Monster, something like that.
They go to robot fights and bet on
right robot fights, and the one that they keep betting on that loses, it's Jizz something. But they're into Josh for a lot of money, and so they initially rob this retirement home, thinking that they could get at least money from one individual to pay off Josh. That doesn't work out, but then they learn that when they go to Josh to say, we don't have the money yet, he tells them, okay, I got something that you can do for me that could be a payoff, and that is, you have to get something through LAX. You know, this right. takes place in Los Angeles. He says, you have to get something through LAX. However, in this story, LAX is notorious for having a faultless drug dog, Pretzels, right? And so then the question becomes how to get rid of Pretzels. And so this is how Roy gets Mac into his job working at LAX with Pretzels, is if Mac appears to be shot in the line of duty, maybe in the hand, something that won't debilitate him, that they'll give him a softer job while he recuperates, one being over at LAX working with the dog unit. And so that's what happens. And the whole exchange about that shooting, right, where Roy shoots Mac in the hand, I mean, that's just a classic representation of the kind of funny relationship we see between Roy and Mac, and between Roy and Mac and their schemes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to come back to Josh for a second because you know, that's another area that I was getting to when I was talking about how Spencer and Lieber subvert our expectations. This is not the kind of mob boss we expect to see. In fact, he seems like a really nice, affable guy. Visually, he's patterned after the comedian Mike Birbiglia. So if anybody is familiar with him. He is a kind of quintessentially nice and affable guy, and often plays that in movies as well. So the idea that this would be a, a mob boss is crazy. But one of the other things that I wanted to mention, and this comes up with Josh, but it comes up in also in the place where you talked about the shooting the hand, is the way Spencer and Lieber use these montage sequences. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, for example, so we see what a nice guy Josh is in his home, and then we get this montage of just kind of what a ruthless, you know, of these alternating panels where he's being a good dad, purchasing organic food, protesting against mandatory vaccinations, while also being a pretty ruthless mob boss as well. And again, so we see several characters, in fact, are introduced through these montages, like
old Donovan,
Roy's buddy, who is also supposedly going to get them into Hollywood to make a movie. So a lot of the comedy comes in those sequences, which are a lot of fun. Also, we get panels that are kind of showing us things that are going on more in Roy's head than they are in the real world. Like, mm-hmm. like when he and Mac are doing an Uncle Scrooge diving through a pile of money when they think about what Hollywood's going to give them, the kind of money Hollywood's going to give them for what they're doing, for their script based on their lives, and so on.
Yeah. The montage scenes, and we see this with a variety of characters. Mm-hmm. We see it, you know, with Josh, with Donovan, with Elena, who is kind of a Miley Cyrus kind of character, yeah. right? Who starts off as a young female star when she was a little girl, then grows up to be this, you know, bad girl in pop culture, not really doing anything really, you know, of substance, but more famous at this point for the sake of being famous. Mm-hmm. But those montage scenes really do a good job of telling you about who the character is. Now, one of the wackiest characters in the series so far is Donovan, mm-hmm. you know, their supposed end to Hollywood. And when we're first introduced to him in a flashback, or at least a story in a flashback, that's where we get this montage that landed Donovan in jail, which is where Mac and Roy meet him. Mm-hmm. And apparently he goes to this mall and just does the weirdest thing, series of actions. It's just strange. And this tells us something about his character. Yeah. He's probably the wildest one mm-hmm. in this bunch. And you know, you've mentioned Lieber's art in the way that he represents some of the craziness that's mm-hmm. going on. You know, that scene where we see them, Roy and Mac, jumping into money like Uncle Scrooge, I think is a great example. Mm-hmm. Another thing I love about Lieber's touches, not just his art, but the little things here or there, is we'll see in certain panels information in little, like, information bubbles or boxes about what something is that we don't have access to visually. So mm-hmm. someone's doing something, and there is a little box with an arrow pointing to whatever it is they're doing, and there's an explanation, either text or visually based, about what that is. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorites is when Roy is working with this, you know, pop star, the young girl Elena, mm-hmm. and, you know, he's with her when she has a binge one night, and she throws up in his car. And what she's throwing up, I mean, you see this stream of green stuff, but in that stream of green stuff are things that she could not have possibly ingested. Right. Things like a telephone, a pocket knife, and things of that sort. I mean, those little bits of humor, I think, go a long way to supplement the more overt humor that's woven throughout.
Right. Yes. And so, yeah, a Rubik's Cube at one point she throws up.
That's great.
Yeah, and I think that's also a part of what I think a larger aspect of the fun of this is that so much of the series is we're in Roy's head, right? This mm-hmm. is Roy's subjective point of view throughout. So that would be an indication of, you know, maybe how he remembered what she threw up.
Right.
And I think that's a neat approach, because a lot of comic creators don't play around with subjective point of view that much. But Spencer and Lieber are showing just how much fun you can have in doing that.
Right. But it also, it's not just, it's much more than having fun. They also complicate things with that subjective point of view. And an example of that is the character of Cheryl Malone, who is Internal Investigations. And there, well, okay, from Roy's point of view, there's something between them, or at least she wants there to be something between them. But we don't see that to be the case. And so I mention this as an example. As you read through this, knowing that we're getting the story through Roy's point of view, you got to take things with a grain of salt, that characters may not be as they appear through Roy's eyes in their situation. So, you know, this is a fun story, and it reminds me of like a cop show on television, but one that is just fun, right? And not just, you know, dramatic. But this is something, it reminds me of a comedic Miami Vice, maybe.
Sure, sure.
And maybe because of the hot weather setting. But this would be a great series for, let's say, Netflix or AMC.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as I was reading it, but also I really admire the way that Spencer and Lieber play with the comics medium. In a way that wouldn't translate in the TV very well. I think this would make a hilarious TV show, don't get me wrong, but I think that they're really making taking advantage of it being a comic.
Right, because many of the things that we were describing you could not do in a TV series, or at least in as an effective way.
Right. Right. So after I read the trade, like I said, I went and picked up the issues 5 and 6. From Steve Lieber right away the next day. And I'm going to start reading this on a monthly basis. It'll probably be a series I have to keep rereading over and over again, because I think it's going to be one that pays off kind of reading big chunks of it at a time to get some of the running gags that are going through it and so on.
Right.
So, but
yeah,
and to kind of figure out where the plot's going anyway, because it's taking so many different paths from when it started.
Yeah. Well, this is one, I'm not going to make any promises, but I'm pretty sure that I will be bringing this title up at least once more this year.
Yeah.
That's how much I like it.
Yep.
Well, Andy, on this first of our two-part recent crime comic series, we discussed a lot. We started off with Chris Hunt's Carver of Paris story. After that, we looked at Angel City number 1, written by Janet Harvey with art by Megan Levins. Then we looked at Moonshine, the first issue, but we also discussed the first or the next two after that, written by Brian Azzarello with art by Eduardo Risso. Then two Titan Comics titles as part of their hard crime comic series, Triggerman number 1 with Walter Hill, Matz, and Jeff. And then Peepland, Krista Faust, Gary Phillips, and Andrea Camerini. And then we looked at Rick Geary's next volume in his Treasury of 20th Century Murder series, Black Dahlia. And then we wrapped up with the wild and wacky world of Nick Spencer and Steve Lieber in The Fix.
Yep, that's a lot to cover in this episode, and we got a lot more coming up.
That's right, because there's a lot of good crime comics coming out now.
Yep.
And if you want great comics like this, crime genre or otherwise, then please visit the website of our sponsor, which is Discount Comic Book Service. Go to dcbservice.com, and there you're going to find great prices on the titles we've discussed on this episode, as well as many other comics as well. And after you do get your comics there, get in touch with us and let us know what you think about the first of our two crime comics series. If you go to the website comicsalternative.com, you'll find that you can leave us a voice message through SpeakPipe, or you can call us over the phone by dialing 415-3-COMICS. That's 415-326-6427.
That's right, or you can get a hold of us by email. We are twoguys@comicsalternative.com, or you can get a hold of us individually. I'm Andy@comicsalternative.com.
And I'm Derek@comicsalternative.com.
And then we have our Twitter feed, which is @the2guyswithPhDs. So check that out.
That's right. You can also find us on other places on social media, such as Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, Google+, Goodreads, Pinterest, and YouTube. You can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. You can stream us on Stitcher. You can find us on TuneIn, on Spotify, and on iHeartRadio. And if you're an Android user, on Google Play Music. But you can find every single one of our podcast episodes, as well as the reviews and the comics-related commentary that we post on our blog, simply by going to our website, comicsalternative.com.
That's right. So that's all the ways to find out what we're up to and to get a hold of us.
That's right. And make sure that you listen to us next week for our second part of the recent crime comic series. And until then, I'm Derek.
And I'm Andy. See ya.